Straight Talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio. You're listening to the Jay Shapiro Show.
Hello again, this is Jay Shapiro. Thanks for listening. Elections have just been called in Israel. They'll take place in April. So this government is not going to complete its term in office. I assume that during the course of the next few months, I'll have lots to say about the election campaign. They tend to be very uncivil here in Israel. This will be the 21st Knesset since the establishment of the state back in 1948. I think that's something we can be proud of, especially in this part of the world. It has been famously said that the Middle East is not the Middle West. When you look at what's happening all around Israel, a non-violent democratic election is something you're very happy and proud about. One of the reasons for calling this election early, if not the main reason, is the fact there are a bunch of indictments against the prime minister, including charges of bribery, which is not something to be happy or proud about. I'll probably have a lot to say more about doing the campaign and about the candidates. In the meantime, I want to say a few words about the previous election in the United States. In particular, I'll speak about several of the newly elected members of the U.S. House of Representatives. I'll speak about them because of their already known positions with regard to the state of Israel and relationship between Israel and the United States. Israel has always succeeded in gaining bipartisan support in U.S. Congress for actions concerning the relationship between our two countries. But this may be in danger because of the outspoken anti-Israel positions taken by a number of newly elected Democrats. The public records show that they are not neutral nor nonpartisan about Israel. They are overtly anti-Israel, and they have already declared that they intend to change the American attitude toward Israel. I'll say a few words about the Iranian strategy to destabilize the areas taken by Israel in the Six-Day War. And these areas are historically called Judea and Samaria, but they're being called the West Bank since the illegal Jordanian occupation in 1948. Israel put an end to that occupation in 1967. It's really Judea and Samaria, not the West Bank. It's a volatile area, and Iran is making it even more volatile. I'll say a few words about that. Again, thanks for listening. I'll be right back.
I'm John O'Vandor.
And I'm Ross Nichols.
Join us on our program, Israel on My Mind, a show that broadcasts all the weekly goodness that flows like milk and honey from the Holy Land straight into your ears with humorous and happy news stories.
We're going to be talking about...
What are we going to talk about?
A person who takes out a terrorist with a pizza tray.
And there's Donald Trump talking to a turkey. What's that about?
A 71-year-old rock star is a staunch supporter of Israel.
Join us on our program, Israel on My Mind.
Every Thursday.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
Hi, you're back with Jay Shapiro. I want to say a few words about the problems that Israel may be facing, serious problems, from the new Democratic control of the U.S. House of Representatives. Israel has always worked and succeeded in getting bipartisan support in the U.S. Congress, which is important. Israel cannot be seen in the Congress as a party issue. But a number of newly elected representatives of a Democratic Party in Congress already have public records that indicate their feelings and the way they will probably vote. I did a little bit of research, and I want to share it with the listeners. When the delegates to the Democratic National Convention assemble less than 2 years from now, the question will be, will a few zealots of anti-Zionism call for the elimination of the entire state of Israel? This same battle has torn apart large portions of the European left. Will it spread to America with national consequences? The people at the Democratic Socialists of America, which is an organization, they're now part of the Democratic Party and is still fairly marginal in American political life. But since the midterm elections several months ago, a few more have taken their place in the U.S. Congress itself, and perhaps more importantly, in the Democratic Party apparatus. In the midterm elections that just went by, a group of female, community-oriented fighters for the poor and the disenfranchised, whose platforms revolved around Medicare for All, quality housing, and free college tuition, ran for office and won. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the candidate-elect for the U.S. House of Representatives from the 14th District of New York, is one. Rashida Tlaib, member-elect of the House of Representatives from Michigan's 13th District. They beat out a large field of African-American politicians to win the primaries. Both these women are card-carrying members of the Democratic Socialists of America. Another one is Ilhan Omar, a Somali-born American. She's a representative-elect from Minnesota's 5th District. She ran as a member of the Democratic Farmer Labor Party. Now, obviously, liberals are excited by the new life injected into the party by these young candidates whose parents are immigrants. However, it turns out that these populist heroines are also Israel haters. Both Tlaib and Omar made policy statements about Israel during their campaigns that they changed after the elections. While running, Tlaib got the endorsement of J Street by saying she supported a two-state solution. After her election, a lawyer and community organizer herself announced that she supported only a single state. One state, she said in a magazine interview. She said it has to be one state. Separate but equal does not work. I'm only 42 years old, but my teachers were of the generation that marched with Martin Luther King. The whole idea of a two-state solution doesn't work. By the way, the day before, she told the Channel 4 News in Britain that she wanted the U.S. to slash funding to Israel. Absolutely, she said, if it has something to do with inequality and not access to people having justice. What happened was that even J Street, which is a radical left-wing organization that pretends to be pro-Israel, later pulled its endorsement of her. The Ilhan Omar, who was born in Somalia, said during her campaign that she did not support BDS, saying that the pressure on Israel would be counterproductive to peace. Now, after being elected, she says both are true. She doesn't think pressure is productive, yet she supports BDS. She was ignorant when a tweet she'd penned in 2012 surfaced, which stated Israel had hypnotized the world and Israel was guilty of evil doings. When offered the chance to clarify her statement, she said these accusations, when she was said that the accusations against her are without merit. She blamed Islamophobia for the strong reaction against her words against Israel. She said they're rooted in bigotry toward a belief about what Muslims are stereotyped to believe. Because of her celebrity aura, the headscarf-wearing Omar has been given a pass on these comments, and she's been treated with kid gloves. Now, the other one that got most of the publicity, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, is a former organizer for Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign. She beat a veteran congressman and took his seat. The upset win of a very bright young lady lit up the left all the way across the country, which appreciated the energy and earnest she brought to the election. She's considered a person of color. Her family comes from Puerto Rico, and she's considered a champion of the working class. She gathered an impressive number of endorsements from national progressive groups, and during the campaign, she too offered some anti-Israel words, including a remark that the Israeli army attempts to keep Hamas protesters from breaching the fence along the Gaza war, and they're doing it in the form of a massacre. It was recently reported that she declined AIPAC's invitation to travel to Israel with the group later this year for her freshman congressional colleagues. The AIPAC, the Israel-American Political PAC, invites members of Congress every year, particularly new members of Congress, to visit Israel. Now, what unites all these candidates is their youth, their powerful media presence, and the Democratic Socialist America, which has its roots in the old Socialist Party of America. The what's happened is that this group is getting bigger, and a lot of young people are joining it. And unfortunately, although it speaks, if you will, for the working class, it's also very anti-Israel. For example, the Portland chapter of the Democratic Socialist America has two women. One is Jewish. They lead the Portland chapter, and they before the concert last March, they took the stage together to welcome their comrades and talk to them about what they called a very important issue, Palestine. Reading from a script, one of them said, "So we want to debunk any myths surrounding the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that paint it as a complicated conflict. Something that has always been around is unsolvable, and we can just let them fight out over there. Don't let anyone fool you into thinking that there is anything other than the illegal and brutal occupation of Israel of the Palestinians, designed and bankrolled by Western imperialist powers. The United States gives Israel $4 billion a year, while Israel subjects Palestinians to unspeakable crimes. Thanks to capitalism, American arms manufacturers and the U.S. corporations profit directly from the occupation of Palestine. And as socialists, we reject all forms of exploitation, oppression, including the profit-driven militarism that has directly led to the dire situation in Palestine today. We need to use the word apartheid to describe the current conditions in Palestine and Israel's sham of democracy." Unquote. So you have these so-called socialists. Let's say they believe much in the socialist theory, but for some reason or other, they seem to associate socialism with being anti-Israel. Interesting, by the way, the State of Israel was essentially founded by socialists, but the socialists today are not simply people worried about economic conditions. They're people who don't like Israel and consider Israel a cruel taskmaster of the Palestinians. By the way, it was Bernie Sanders who introduced these women to socialism. He was saying all these policies, and it made sense to them. Sanders said he was a democratic socialist, so these young ladies checked the organization out. And that's where they learned much more about socialism, capitalism, and about how all their struggles are connected. So, for example, one of the things they did was they demonstrated against the commissioning of an amphibious transport dock ship. They say that Trump is clearly trying to escalate military action in Syria, which, by the way, is very funny because this week he announced he's pulling all the American troops out. And they complained that the ship cost $1.6 billion. All the money could be better used by spending around the globe, education, housing, and many things. The Democratic Socialists of America believe in dismantling the capitalist system, and some followers even believe in the erasure of all natural boundaries. So I'm not quite sure what democratic socialism means. I don't dare sure either. But they seem unified by the belief that capitalism and conventional politics have failed their generation. These are mostly young people. They also are unified in their belief that Israel is the enemy of the righteous. Matter of fact, many of them work for the passage of a BDS resolution. And, and one of their meetings, they kept shouting from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. And by the way, this is not a peaceful wish. It's a call for the elimination of Jews between the Mediterranean Sea and the Jordan River. So you have these people, several of which were elected to Congress and Democratic Party, who claim to be socialists, which they may well be. Unfortunately, being a socialist no longer means you have a position on economic policy. For some reason or other, being a socialist today means you're also anti-Israel. And not only anti-Israel in a strong sense, they're seeking the destruction of the state of Israel. So these are the people who are now moving into the Democratic Party, or they've moved in already, and are also going to be part of the party apparatus. So I think there's a very small number in the 435 seat House of Representatives, but the fact remains it's a new element, it's a vociferous element, it's a bright young element, and it may bode trouble for the bi-party support of Israel that we've worked for so many years. So I just want to pass this information off to the listeners. I just learned it myself. I'll be back after the break.
Hi, everyone. This is Andrea Simintow from Jerusalem, inviting you to drop everything and join me on my show, Pull Up a Chair. We'll visit this week's quirky stories, meet fabulous guests, and discover my Israel. Together, we'll laugh, shout, and explain the topics that make us say, hey, we've got to talk about that. So get comfortable and pull up a chair with me, Andrea Simintov, every Thursday on Israel News Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
You're back with Jay Shapiro. Although I don't like to talk about geopolitics as a rule, because I do not consider myself expert enough to talk about it. There's all kind of people who think they're experts, but I think I have to say something about the American withdrawal from Syria, which was announced last week. And what's going to happen is, I think, we will most likely see the spread of Iranian influence in the region that will increase further problems. The circumstances needed for the Iranian regime to build a continuous corridor extending from Iran to Lebanon and to the Mediterranean Ocean are taking place before the world's eyes. And the there are possible issues that the current United States withdrawal will cause, not only for the region, but for the world. It's interesting, by the way, that a lot of people don't seem to realize that the major Shiite country, there's a difference between the Shiite Muslims and the Sunni Muslims, and they're not too crazy about each other. Most of the Muslim countries in this area, particularly Saudi Arabia, are Sunni, and the Iranians are Shiite. And as I said, they're not too crazy about each other. Now, what's happened is that since Israel's founding in 1948, our neighbors have repeatedly tried to throw the Jews into the sea. Until the 1979 Iranian Revolution, this was primarily a Sunni-dominated project. At that time, the Shah of Iran, who was a Shiite, of course, but he was thrown out, and he was replaced by the Khomeini regime, which is a proactive Shiite movement. So now there are two Sunni Arab nations that have peace treaties with Israel, although they're kind of cold ones. Meanwhile, the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, Oman, Bahrain, and United Arab Emirates are openly speaking about Israel as a reality in the region. So from the Sunni perspective, their cooperation with Israel is primarily motivated by their need to contain the aspirations of Iran, whose desire is to overthrow the conservative Gulf states, Egypt, and Jordan, while conquering Mecca and Medina for Shiite Islam. It's their own internal Muslim problem. And the Sunni nations know that a weakened and besieged Israel is not good for their own survival. Of course, who could have imagined such a thing happening just a short time ago? Iran has been methodically planning the destruction of Israel for decades. The destruction of the Jewish state constitutes an important tenet of their devotion to Islam. and it reflects a deep ideological conviction in the indispensability of annihilating the Zionist entity as part of their belief. Getting rid of Israel is part of their belief. Now, Iran has made a lot of progress recently in turning this rhetoric. Iran has made a lot of progress recently in turning rhetoric into gains. President Bashar Assad of Syria is now beholden to the Iranian regime for saving his own regime. Assad in Syria has allowed Iran to ethnically cleanse the Sunnis of southern Syria. Assad, by the way, is neither a Sunni nor a Shiite. He belongs to an altogether different group. And what's happening is that Assad has allowed Iran to ethnically cleanse the Sunnis of southern Syria, which is on the border of Israel, and he's repopulating the border region facing Israel, Golan Heights, with Shiites from Lebanon, Iraq, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. And those Shiite settlers are being naturalized as Syrian citizens, which is undermining the Russian guarantee to remove an Iranian presence on the Israeli frontier. So we have Iran moving in on the our border in the Golan Heights. Iran is firmly entrenched in the north of Syria with Hezbollah, which is also in control of the Lebanese government. It even allows Iran, Lebanon allows Iran to fly weapons directly into the Beirut airport for Hezbollah. Now, for some reason or other, America pretends that Lebanese armed force is an independent force, but it really isn't. Iran has at its disposal a Hezbollah arsenal estimated 150,000 missiles, many capable of hitting anywhere in Israel, with many new military facilities scattered throughout Syria and Lebanon. This is already a fait accompli that could only be undone with a major military operation that Israel is pretty much loath to attempt. And now that the United States is pulling out of Syria, that sort of changed the whole situation and puts a bigger burden on the shoulders of Israel. Now, that's in the north, in Lebanon, the Syrian border. But in the south, Hamas, along the Palestinian Islamic along with the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, is a constant source of problems for Israel. They know in Gaza, where Hamas rules, they know their existence is not threatened because they realize that Israel has absolutely no desire whatsoever to go back into Gaza. So apparently the Iranians' next goal for their long-term strategy to destroy Israel is a complete destabilization of what they call the West Bank and what we call Judea and Samaria. What they want to do, that is where the Palestinian Authority theoretically rules. The only reason it rules in the West Bank is because the Israeli army protects Palestinian Authority. Otherwise, Hamas would take full control of the West Bank with billions of dollars of Iranian money and supplies. This explains Israel, Jordan, America's desire to prop up the corrupt and inept Palestinian Authority and its security services, because if the Palestinian Authority wasn't there, things would be much worse for Jordan and for Israel. It's a very touchy situation. So every new round of violence in the West Bank is a victory for Iran's long-term goal, which is creating a foundation for the rise of Hamas and fulfilling its strategy to encircle Israel, forcing it to fight repeated multi-front wars from Gaza, from Lebanon, from Syria, and from the West Bank. That's what Israel is facing right now. The border with Egypt is quiet. The Sinai border is quiet. But we have one on essentially almost completely encircled by people who are out to destroy Israel, and they're being supported by Iran. And a new front on the West Bank would accelerate the Iranian beachhead, which, according to the Israeli military intelligence, acts as a cover for Iran's nuclear weapons program. What they do is creating a deterrence barrier against any preemptive strike on its nuclear program. Now, if this round of violence in the West Bank turns into a third intifada, what will probably happen is a Palestinian civil war, because Hamas is going to try to kick out the Palestinian Authority. It's the primary beneficiary will be Iran. So Abbas, the head of the Palestinian Authority, who's now in the 10th year of his four-year term, is caught between a rock and a hard place. His organization, the PLO, Fatah, the Palestinian Authority, need to cooperate with Israel's for the very survival. But they also see their hold on power evaporating if they're not more radical than Hamas. So you have a Palestinian Authority that has to be more radical, otherwise it's going to lose the support of its people. At the same time, it needs Israel to protect it from the radicals. So it's a really wild and weird situation. So what happens is, I think, America needs to use whatever influence it remains to persuade Jordan and Egypt to lobby the Palestinian Authority to continue to work with Israel's security for its own survival, and try to convince others to use all their influence to restrain Hamas in the West Bank. So you have a situation where, you know, the enemy you know is better than the enemy you don't know. Hamas is a bad group. The Palestinian Authority is a bad group. But the Palestinian Authority is not as bad as Hamas, because they want to remain in power in the West Bank. When they left the Gaza area, they were violently thrown out. So here you have a Palestinian Authority who doesn't love Israel, and it pays the families of people who terrorize Israel. But the alternative could be worse. So you have Israel has to support Hamas. I'm sorry, Israel has to support the Palestinian Authority, because if Hamas takes over, it'll get worse. And this is the same problem for Jordan. Jordan is scared to death of the Palestinian Authority, but it's more frightened by Hamas. So the Middle East was never a simple place, but it's gotten more complicated. And I don't know whether the withdrawal of American troops in the long run is good or bad. As I said at the beginning of this segment, I don't like to do much geopolitical thinking, because I don't know all the details and I don't study this kind of thing full time. I rely on the people who are supposed to study the details and know what's going on. But if you just look at the headlines of the papers every day, and you look where we are compared to where back in 1993, before we brought the Palestinian Authority back from from Tunisia, where we were a heck of a lot better off then than we are now. But these are the facts on the ground. So I tried to do a little bit of analysis from my simple viewpoint, and I hope it clarified some things for the listeners. I'll be back after the break.
Leap of Faith with Penina Taylor.
We live in the age of information, but not inspiration. If you're like me, you're looking to be inspired, to reach higher, to connect more, and to grow. Well, if you want to get warm, you need to stand close to the fire. And if you want to catch fire, you need to stand close enough to get hit by the sparks. Join me, Penina Taylor, as we walk with people who have embarked on a spiritual journey towards Torah. We'll uncover what started them on their journey and what truths they discovered along the way. So prepare to be inspired as we take a leap of faith every Sunday at 5 p.m. on Israel News Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
Hello again, you're back with Jay Shapiro. Our government just announced that there's going to be an election on April 9th. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the implications. First of all, the news of having elections April 9th which is less than half a year from now, is certainly going to affect the Trump administration's plan for what they're talking about, the Middle East Peace Initiative, which they're supposed to come up with. The Trump administration prefers that Netanyahu should win, but that's another story. The truth of the matter is that the White House officials are likely today to release because they're afraid both the perception of election interference in Israel as any other unintended political consequences that are sure to arise from the contents of the plan. So obviously the Americans cannot bring forth their peace plan, if they have one, before the election, because they'll have a big impact on the election. Newspapers have reported Netanyahu requested a delay from the Trump administration. So the administration's desire to get along with the peace process may have factored in Netanyahu's call for elections 7 months earlier than necessary. So having a date gives Donald Trump's team some clarity on its own timing, because they're presuming probably that Netanyahu will emerge victorious and continue being the prime minister. That's what it looks like at the moment. The election of a prime minister to Netanyahu's political right would likely kill the plan, because the further you are to the right politically you are in Israel, the less you're willing to compromise with the Palestinians. And the U.S. officials probably doubt that anyone to the left in Netanyahu could put together a government coalition. So now Trump's peace team is assessing precisely how the April date will alter their rollout. The president's aides earlier this year had thought that the release of the plan might prove an election-inducing event, but now that the election's already set, they face a new situation. As a matter of fact, one of the White House officials said the other day that the upcoming election in Israel on April 9th is one of the many factors we're considering in evaluating the timing of the release of the peace plan, which sort of implies that there is a peace plan already. But I don't know how true that is. While elections may provide the White House with confidence it will release its plan with a stable Israeli government in office, they also amount to yet another hurdle toward the launch. Once slated, this peace plan was slated for release in the spring, then in the summer, and then the American President Trump claimed in September that the initiative would finally launch by the end of the year. We're now a week before the end of the year, and that's not happening. Now they're talking about February or March. Oh, now, but since we're having an election in April, it's probably slide. But interestingly enough, if it slides past April, it'll possibly slide into the time when the U.S. presidential election cycle is going on. There's an election to 2020 in the United States, and if they wait until the middle of 2019 to release the plan, it's going to affect a lot of things, and probably including the Jewish vote in the United States. They continue to say that they'll release the plan when the timing is right, but the developments such as the breakdown in U.S.-Palestinian communications another thing which may affect, believe it or not, according to some reports I've read, there was a killing of this Saudi Arabian diplomat, Jamal Khashoggi, and maybe that's contributed to delay. So a summer release in 2019 would give the Trump team just 1 year to pursue peace before the 2020 election. And since we've been unable to have peace with the Arabs for about 100 years or so, the chances of being able to get something done in the last year before the U.S. election is pretty improbable, if not simply impossible. And since we're talking about the election, an interesting question is, how much will the elections cost the economy? Elections are a very costly business. We have here state financing for party campaigns, for Central Elections Committee operation, and additional public holiday on election day when people are not working. And the election is going to come with a pretty hefty price tag. Like many Western countries, Israel provides substantial state funding for political parties and their campaigns. According to some estimates, state funding for parties could cost the state more 300 million shekels during the election period, including the financing of major party primaries for the first time after legislation passed early this year that banned candidates from receiving contributions or taking out loans. So now they're going to have to, the government's going to have to provide money. The budget for the Central Elections Committee, which is the body charged with overseeing the elections, stands at about 283 million shekels, which is a 17% increase over the last election, which was held back in 2015. The greatest cost, however, is Election Day itself. It's a paid vacation day for almost the entire workforce in Israel, and the loss in working hours is expected to cost the country as much as 5 billion shekels. This estimate is based on the annual gross GDP. The elections they wanted to have as quickly as possible, according to the finance minister, because the shorter the elections are, the less it'll cost the country. It's true that rapid elections means lower campaigning costs, but there's little evidence to suggest that calling elections will have a lasting impact on the national economy. The relatively short electoral campaign and the certainty that will be restored to the market immediately after election could mitigate any negative impact on the economy in the build-up to the elections. Even following the surprising margin of Netanyahu's victory back in 2015, shares on the Tel Aviv stock market remain largely indifferent to the political outcome. So there are people who believe that rapid elections really do not have a major impact on a real economy, on growth or the fiscal deficit. So it's hard to know exactly what an election will cost. So it might lead to a weaker shekel or stronger, who knows. Regardless of who wins and what coalitions form, people have a sense that uncertainty is coming to an end on election day, and so have the opposite effect. People will know where the country stands and who has the government, whether it'll be a strong government. I think that will affect the confidence people have in the economy. So, there was a slight dip in the stock exchange earlier this week, two or three days ago, when they decided to call the elections. So the stock exchange has been a little bit weak in Israel. So I assume that the Israeli economy will continue to remain far more sensitive to global markets in the coming months than the upcoming elections. Israel's stock market reflects what's happening around the world, not just what's happening in Israel. Now it turns out, by the way, that the election is not taking place simply because of other things, but because of the graft. Namely, there are three criminal investigations hovering over Netanyahu's head. And the question is the Attorney General likely to recommend to indict Netanyahu? And would it happen before the race? There's a lot of leaks coming out of the government because the criminal investigations might result in Netanyahu being indicted. So the question we can ask ourselves, can it be a coincidence that after 2 years overcoming threats to his coalition, Netanyahu suddenly decided to have an election the day after Mandelblit, the Attorney General, started working on his case? So there are a lot of things happening that I guess are under the table. Right now, Netanyahu is the prime minister, defense minister, foreign minister, health minister, the head of the Likud party, and now he's an ordinary citizen in a sense because he's fighting multiple criminal probes. So it's no wonder that Netanyahu really wants to set up the election. They think that'll cause everything to stop. The Knesset is going to be dispersed this week, and Netanyahu can hold on to all these portfolios until the next government is sworn in. So he was facing a choice of choosing a new foreign minister, and now that can be forgotten because he's not going to choose a new foreign minister when there really is no government in place until the election, a new coalition is formed. So I don't know if this is standard in many countries. We'd like to think that Israel's a stable government, and we'd like to think that elections are called for good reasons. And I don't know whether the indictment or preventing the indictment of the prime minister is a good reason. After 2,000 years of not having a state, we'd like to think we run the state in such a way that the indictment of a prime minister won't affect the election or calling of an election, and the election is going to cost a lot of money. And it's an interesting situation. There's never a dull day here in Israel. Even the timing of an election can be a major political issue with all kind of ramifications. Having said that, I'll be back next week. Take care of yourselves. Jay Shapiro, signing off.
If you love Israel News Talk Radio, then you'll love our Facebook page. We keep you up to date on what's happening in Israel, plus little surprise treasures that we don't share on the radio. Go now to follow us on Facebook. Just look for the Israel News Talk Radio Facebook page, and don't forget to subscribe and follow us by clicking on the like button. We post great stuff there that you'll want to share. Israel News Talk Radio on Facebook and Israel News Radio on Twitter.
If you're hearing this message, everyone else can too. Advertise with Israel News Talk Radio and get your message out to people. We'll build a personalized package for you. Contact advertising at israelnewstalkradio.com.
Straight talk from Israel. You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
Hey, this is Jake in Anchorage, Alaska, and I love listening to all the super interesting interviews and up-to-date information on what's happening in Israel.
Hello, this is Anna King, originally from London, now living in Israel. And what can I say? Israel News Talk Radio is my cup of tea.
My name is Bhaskar. I'm from India, and I love listening because you get to know the truth and wonderful voices from this lovely country.
Mom!
Okay, wait a minute.
Hi, this is Chava Dax, and I'm calling for the rolling hills of Maale Adumim, just north of Jerusalem. I always listen to Israel News Talk Radio to get all the latest news and commentary and to keep me up to date every day.
This is Sarah Dax from Maale Adumim, and I'm 12. I wish Israel News Talk Radio was boring so my mom wouldn't listen to it all the time. Mom!
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
News, opinion, and more. You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.